Hurricane Michael, the strongest storm since Andrew to hit Florida, rakes across the panhandle, leaving behind devastation and tens of thousands without power. This is the Florida Roundup from WLRN Public Media in Miami and WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville. I'm Tom Hudson. My co-host Melissa Ross is out this week. Michael went from a tropical depression to a menacing Category 4 hurricane in less than a week, bringing with it damaging winds and disastrous storm surge. What's the latest on the damage estimates and recovery efforts? What's needed now? And how could the storm change the panhandle? This week, a global climate change report warns unprecedented changes are needed to keep the Earth from heating up too much. It predicts stronger storms, higher seas, and hotter weather. Plus, the trauma faced by first responders after tragedies. The Florida Roundup is next. Welcome to the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. My co-host Melissa Ross is out this week. She'll be back next Friday. Last night, five of Florida's 67 counties spent the night in the dark. There was no power in Calhoun, Gadsden, Jackson, Liberty, and Washington counties. None of those counties have any Gulf of Mexico coastline in the panhandle of Florida. But while some of those areas with seashore may have had some lights on, the devastation left over from Hurricane Michael earlier this week is just breathtaking. Not since August of 1992 has Florida and Floridians witnessed this kind of wholesale, widespread destruction from a hurricane. Homes and businesses, entire neighborhoods and towns have been turned to rubble. Michael's winds were just shy of Category 5 speed. Its storm surge sent 9 feet or more of water barreling well inland. Michael was a historic storm, and it will require a historic response in the state of Florida. That's where we will begin this week on the Florida Roundup. 305-995-1800 is our statewide hotline, 305-995-1800, or you can join us on Twitter, at Florida Roundup is our Twitter handle. The storm went from a depression to a serious Category 4 storm in less than a week, barreling through the Gulf of Mexico en route to the panhandle. Did you evacuate? How are the early response efforts going? When will you return? How vulnerable is the panhandle to this type of destruction? We'll talk about those questions with you, 305-995-1800. We spoke with NPR's Greg Allen just a few moments ago.
Well, today we're in East Point. I'm here with my producer, Becky Sullivan, and we were visiting some of the oyster families, people who run oyster houses here along the Apalachicola Bay. And really a lot of the places on the shore side, the beach side of 98, Highway 98 here are gone. There are a few kind of well-built ones that are still standing. And we talked to Stephanie Barber at Barber Seafood. She is still shipping out some oysters and stuff today. They're still working. They got a lot of damage here. She doesn't think they'll be oystering anytime soon, but they're still in business. Talked to Lynn Martina at Lynn's Quality Seafood. It's a retail store and restaurant. They took a pretty bad hit, and there's no power, so they're not sure when they'll reopen, but she's sure they're going to. So that storm surge did a lot of damage here in East Point.
Yeah, it did, up to 4 feet, according to the initial reports. Did those folks evacuate and come back, or did they shelter in place during Michael?
Everybody I talked to sheltered here, not right at the water, not at the business properties, but everybody was back a little bit. And, as bad as the storm surge was here, it's so far from what I've been able to tell. It really only affected the businesses on the sounds on the ocean side, and then about a block back, not too far back so far. But we're still talking to folks. But the people who Stephanie Barber said her house came through fine, although the wind was terrifying, and we heard some of the same things from Lynn Martina. So, this part is really about the businesses more than anything else.
Now, you're not in the hardest hit part of the panhandle. You're a little bit east of there. But what has been your sense of the initial response from first responders, National Guard, and other agencies trying to get on the ground?
Well, yesterday we were in Mexico Beach, where Michael came ashore, and that the damage is just stupendous there. It's just, it's awful. That hardly a house in Mexico Beach, which is a pretty small community, but still hardly a house was unscathed. I mean, we saw entire structures just demolished, picked up, thrown on top of other structures. A lot of roofs missing, front walls missing on houses. So that was pretty, and then we talked to a number of people who stayed through the storm for various reasons. And they all, there's no power there, no cell service. They're really kind of starting to wonder when aid was going to get there. We did see convoys of crews heading in there as we were leaving yesterday, and we were told that FEMA was expected by today there in Mexico Beach. But they certainly need the help there, and I think people are kind of hoping that is coming soon.
And what about the transportation network, the road network? What's your experience as you've moved along that panhandle along the coastline?
Well, you know, the first priority was search and rescue, and I think they pretty much got that completed. And then yesterday, they were really starting to work heavily on the roads. When we drove in early to Mexico Beach, it was nearly a 2.5-hour drive from Tallahassee. It was 9 hours of just one small road, dodging piles of debris, of trees down, and waiting behind road crews. It took us forever to get to Mexico Beach. And when we came out, the roads were substantially clearer. I mean, work was going on all day yesterday and today. We drove down here to East Point, which is an area that's less affected, of course, but the roads were just totally clear. So I think Interstate 10, I think there still needs a lot of attention. I don't think it's open totally yet, but I would hope that by the end of the day or by tomorrow, it should be.
NPR's Greg Allen with us in the Apalachicola Bay of Florida. Greg, thanks so much, and be safe today.
Sure, will do. Thanks, Tom.
Dolores Hinckley is a reporter for WUFT Public Radio in Gainesville. She joins us now from those studios. Dolores, you spent the storm. You spent Michael in the Bay County Emergency Operations Center near Panama City. What did you see around Panama City when you were able to finally get out of that EOC?
Yeah, so, I mean, when we first got out, what kind of hit you, which was interesting, the first thing that hit you was the smell of pine trees. There were so many trees downed in that area. The EOC is kind of in that outmost evacuation zone. So there was just a lot of trees, a lot of neighborhoods. So many trees were down. Those roads were blocked initially. We didn't even make it to Mexico Beach. We got as far as Lynn Haven. But, you know, the destruction was so widespread there. Regardless, you know, those massive trees were uprooted. Nowhere you looked was really untouched. I saw buildings with brick walls that looked basically peeled off, people's houses, just trees through them all the way back. Modular homes, as you can imagine, fared much, much worse.
Dolores, did people evacuate in the area? Were they moving away from that coastline as you got put in place at the EOC?
By the time I got to the EOC, everybody was bunkered down. And then when I got out, I met people that, chose not to evacuate, and they just did what they could. Either they were telling me that they couldn't make it, they had too many kids, or they just thought that it wasn't going to be so bad. I mean, it really turned into such a massive storm so quickly. I met families that said, I'd been through Katrina, through Opal, through other storms. But they told me this time, after what they went through and just barely holding on to their lives, they're going to evacuate next time.
Brian Norcross is a hurricane specialist for WPLG Television in Miami, formerly with the Weather Channel. He's with us here. We'll talk about the speed at which Michael developed and came into the panhandle. Dolores, we've heard some reports of folks that didn't evacuate because they couldn't find any gasoline or provisions to get out. What kind of preparations did you see before the storm?
Yeah, driving up into Bay County to that EOC, basically the roads were clear. Apart from in those gas stations that weren't boarded up, you saw people filling up about as last minute. And then getting out, for us, it took us to go through Georgia and then back down through Tallahassee into areas that were also really hard hit. No service, and then gas was scarce. So by the time we got to Tallahassee, we found some gas, but people were still loading up even after the storm, just trying to get out.
Dolores, stick with us. 305-995-1800, talking about Hurricane Michael. What do you want to know? Did you evacuate? Are you curious and worried about friends or family in the panhandle? What have you heard from associates that may be living in or around the worst and hardest hit areas of Panama City? 305-995-1800. Let's go to Tallahassee, WFSU, and the news director at our sister station in the capital city, Lynn Hatter. Lynn, describe the state response here in the two and a half days or so since folks were able to kind of assess the initial damage.
Well, state responders are still trying to get out into some of these outlying counties, as you've just heard. It's really difficult getting out into Bay County, especially. Roads are still heavily blocked, as you now know. The same is true for Franklin County, where Greg is, actually, in Apalachicola. Highway 98, a major artery, currently washed out. The state is trying to figure out how to rebuild a giant chunk of that between East Point and Caribou. That's about a 30-mile stretch right there, and it is coastal, and it's buckled, its parts of it are gone, and so the state is really focused on how to get these roadways back up and running and really how to get crews on the ground. I actually talked to some people out in Panama City who said that today they're now starting to see utility vehicles rolling in, and both Bay and Franklin had pretty much blocked people from coming into their areas. Only the first responders and only the utility crews were they trying to let in. Everybody else they've told to basically wait. And so that's pretty much where we are now.
I want to ask you about those utility crews, but also for folks who may be listening in other parts of the state that evacuated, the message from first responders is to stay away for now, Lynn?
The message is to stay away from now. There's massive damage. The further out west you go from Tallahassee, the worse the damage gets. Because, again, the hurricane did come inshore. As soon as you get to Panama City, it's starting to look just really bad. We've got aerial photos. We had to actually helicopter a crew over there from Florida State University because the Panama City campus is completely wrecked. So they're telling people to stay away, and the damage on the ground is, I mean, it looks like a bomb hit it. That's the best way I can describe it. And that's from the images that I've seen that were given to me by Florida State University officials. I'm looking at them right now. It's really bad.
Yeah. For folks that have seen this devastation, Brian Norcross, hurricane specialist with WPLG television in Miami, formerly of the Weather Channel. Brian, when you see this video, for anybody who lived in South Florida in 1992, it is a very familiar scene of just utter devastation.
It's reminiscent of that bomb went off kind of thing. It's caused by different things. In South Florida, the visuals that we have in our mind are really all windstorm.
Hurricane Andrew.
From Hurricane Andrew. When we look at Mexico Beach, we're talking about mostly storm surge there. They got wind and storm surge, but it was the storm surge that pushed one house into the next one and wiped the houses off those slabs. Of course, they had houses sitting right on the ground, right next to the beach, too, which would not be generally recommended in coastal communities these days.
And we'll talk a little bit about building codes and how the panhandle was situated to handle this or not. Lynn, let me ask you about power outages and communications. I mentioned five counties in Florida were entirely in the dark last night. You mentioned some utility crews getting through. What about communications and cell phone service?
Communication and cell phone service is completely down in Bay County. I have not been able to verify this, but I have been told we actually have a tower in Bay County, and I believe that there might be something on our tower in Bay County that has fallen off. And so there are crews heading out now to our tower in Bay County just to see if they can't get it back up. Bay County has no communication systems. They've been using sat phones and basically sending carrier pigeons to get messages out now. And there are actually nine counties in North Florida right now that are at 99% of people without power. Yeah. So it is significant.
Dolores Hinckley with WUFT, what were your experiences with communication as you left Bay County in the Panama City area in the hours after the storm and made your way through back into Central Florida?
Yeah, I mean, it was no better. Bay County, there was maybe one bar of service sometimes occasionally, and at certain points it got worse. For a lot of families that I met on the way out, you know, they had the same thing too. They couldn't get in contact with their families just to let them know that they had made it through the storm.
Yeah.
So, you know, that communication was down all the way through.
Let me take a phone call from Sarasota. Brent on line four. Brent, go ahead. You're on the radio.
Yes, hi. Thank you. My name's Brent. I'm driving a large truck that I've rented from Sarasota, filled with equipment, generators, gas cans, food, water, blankets, tents, supplies, and so on. And I want to distribute those in churches and community centers in the hardest hit area, which I suppose is Panama City. I hope to drive tomorrow, arrive in the afternoon, and I'm wondering what the access will be for a medium-sized truck into those areas.
Lynn, let me put that question to you. I think I-10 is back open now. Is that correct?
I-10 is back open, but they are not yet anyone aside from first responders off of the I-10 exit to Panama City. So I would suggest if you are going to try and get there, you're going to have to take some alternative routes. And that's true for a lot of these places. Again, first responders only is what they're stressing on the ground, because the damage is so severe, the infrastructure damage is so severe, that really you're going to have to take the back roads. And to be quite honest, it's going to take you a while. We actually have a crew that's currently stuck and trying to figure out a way to get back home. So,
Greg Allen described the trip yesterday from Tallahassee to Mexico Beach as a 9-hour trip in order to get there. In Orlando, Lisa on line 5. Go ahead, Lisa. You're on the radio.
Hi, yes. There is a major state prison, Gulf Correctional Institute in Wewehitchka, which is directly behind Mexico Beach. And I'm just curious as to whether or not there are any reports about such facilities. Do they evacuate the prisoners? Is there any power in the institute? I mean, it's just I'm curious about that situation.
Gotcha. Lynn, any update on that prison, that correctional institution?
Yes, I do believe that that correctional institution was evacuated prior to the storm. I believe that Governor Rick Scott did say that in one of his briefings. So they did actually get people out of some of those facilities prior to the storm.
Looking ahead here, Brian, I looked at the forecast today for the Panhandle, low 80s. Today.
Yeah, so that's a really
good
thing.
It's going to heat up to almost 90 degrees by the middle of next week, though.
Yes, but they're going to get a break here, which often happens after fall hurricanes. It happened here after Hurricane Wilma in South Florida, the drier, cooler.
That was an October hurricane.
Relatively better air comes in. But hurricane season is not over, and we're still in the south, and it's still a hot month. So this is not going to be pleasant. It's going to get hot before the power comes back on, you can bet.
There was a Florida Atlantic University study that coincidentally was released this week. The 10 counties in Florida that had the lowest level of evacuation readiness are in the Panhandle and in North Florida. They were rated on 6 categories, such as special needs registries, pickup location plans, maps, and plans for pet evacuations. Lynn Hatter with our sister station in Tallahassee, WFSU. What's the kind of quick assessment of the evacuation readiness, especially in a storm like Michael that clearly did not give people much time to prepare?
Well, yeah, we've heard from people who said that they didn't know it was going to be this bad. A lot of people did not heed those evacuation orders, and have talked to people on the ground who say now they wish they had. They've been critical, really, of sort of some of the weather information that they got. They said, you know, we heard it was going to be a Category 2. We heard it was going to be a Category 3, and then, oh, my God, it's a Cat 4. And that just really speaks to how strong and how fast this storm came up. And really, some of these smaller communities, it's really important to know some of these small coastal communities are low-income communities. They're cash-based. They don't have a lot of people. And that really affects how people can get out, and really even if people could evacuate if they wanted to. If you don't have a car, you can't go anywhere. And so that really, you know, contributes to the decision-making of some of these people who, you know, in a lot of cases may have had no choice but to stay because they could not get out.
Let's take a quick call in Miami Lakes in South Florida. Renee on line 2. Renee, I'm tight on time. Please make your comment quickly.
All right. Real quick here. The building codes that are currently enacted in Panama City in that area is similar to what's available in Dade County. And why is there so much difference between a Dade County code and a Broward County code when it's just, you know, there's no, nature knows no boundaries.
Yeah, certainly that is true. Those two South Florida counties. Renee, just quick on time. I want to give Brian Norcross a chance to respond to that. The Dade County, South Florida codes were changed considerably in 92 or after the 92 Andrew experience.
Yeah, effective in October of 94. It was a lot of work. And the Dade and Broward codes are not significantly different. The Broward code at the very top end is a tiny bit less. But the codes in Bay County and the Panhandle are drastically less, and I think shamefully less than they are here in South Florida.
And how much less? I mean, the wind code in South Florida, homes must be built to withstand what kind of wind?
Category 4 winds.
And in the Panhandle?
High-end Category 2, low-end Category, nominally 110 miles per hour.
Significant difference then.
In the Panama City area. Now, in the Western Panhandle, oddly, they're higher for no real good meteorological reason.
Brian Norcross is a hurricane specialist for WPLG Television in Miami, formerly with the Weather Channel. He's going to stick with us. I want to send my thanks to Lynn Hatter, news director at WFSU in Tallahassee. Thank you for your hard work and continued hard work. And Dolores Hinckley, reporter for WUFT in Gainesville. Ladies, thank you so much for joining us here on the Florida Roundup. We got plenty more to come. 305-995-1800 statewide on the Florida Roundup. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Thanks again for listening this week. My co-host Melissa Ross is out. She'll be back next Friday on the broadcast. The scope of the damage left by Hurricane Michael is becoming more and more clear by the hour. Beachside communities wiped out by the storm surge and torrential winds. Catastrophic damage at the Air Force Base, the Tyndall Air Force Base. Billions of dollars in damage just mounting right now, and a rising death toll across the path of the storm through at least a half dozen states. Now, while attention is appropriately focused right now on helping the victims of the storm, especially here in Florida, the science of the storm will be examined for weeks, months, possibly years to come to learn more about how quickly the storm strengthened and the conditions that fueled and routed the storm to the panhandle. This week, an international group of scientists released a report warning of stronger storms, higher seas, and hotter weather without unprecedented changes to limit global warming. So how common are the conditions that fed Hurricane Michael in the past week? With hotter temperatures, what's at risk throughout low-lying Florida? Are you changing your behavior or looking to get out of Florida or move away from the coastline because you're worried about climate change? 305-995-1800, statewide, that phone number, 305-995-1800. Or, of course, you can find us on social media at Florida Roundup on Twitter. Brian Norcross, a hurricane specialist for WPLG Television in Miami, formerly of the Weather Center, is still with us. And Kate Stein, the environmental and transportation reporter in South Florida for WLRN. Brian, I want to circle back around to the forecasting of Hurricane Michael. We heard it in some of the phone calls in the last segment, concerns voiced about the accuracy of the forecast. And it's a common criticism after a storm. There's no doubt about it. What's your kind of quick assessment about the accuracy of the cone and the accuracy of the intensity of Hurricane Michael?
Now, the bottom line is they had 2 days warning that a very bad hurricane was coming. If you looked at the actual numbers, it was a Category 3 hurricane forecast 2 days in advance. The rule, the emergency management rule, is you always add a category to that, because it's well known that forecasts for the intensity of a storm in the future generally plus or minus one category, and sometimes even more than that. The bottom line is that you wouldn't prepare any differently for a Category 3 than a Category 4. Now, I take those people at their word that they heard it was a 1 or they heard it was a 2, and they kind of reacted to that, because people react fairly early in the process and make their commitment on what they're going to do. They don't decide at the last minute on what to do. They start early. And our system here is not conducive to people making good decisions.
What do you mean by early? Our system?
Well, the hurricane watch goes up, which is the first official alerting from the National Hurricane Center, nominally 2 days before the wind starts blowing. People start mentally preparing well before that,
if they have the opportunity.
Well, even if it's not possible for them and they can't, it's in their mind. They're making decisions. They're making calls.
Yeah.
They're talking to their friends. What they do in other countries is they put up something akin to a risk area. They'll say it's a signal 1 situation now. It will go to a signal 2 tomorrow if this keeps happening. And everybody knows, boy, if it goes to a signal 4, we're in deep trouble.
Mm-hmm.
But they understand the ramp up of risk. So it's not a commitment to what it's going to be. It's an elevation of risk day by day. And we all focus on what the forecast is a number of days in advance. And by its nature, it's uncertain, and has increased uncertainty the more time in the future you're talking about it.
Senator Bill Nelson blamed global warming for how Michael grew into a monster storm. He told CNN yesterday, quote, "Listen to the scientists at the National Weather Service and they'll tell you that the earth is heating up and the ferociousness of these storms is as a result, in part, of that heating up of the earth, end quote. That was from Senator Bill Nelson. Brian, the science is still being collected on Hurricane Michael, certainly, but what were the conditions that fueled that rapid intensification? It went from a depression to a Cat 4 in less than a week.
So, which is not uncommon in the Gulf of Mexico, by the way. It's also not uncommon near Florida. Hurricane Andrew went from a Category 1 storm, barely a hurricane, to hitting as a Category 5 in exactly 2 days. So in the waters around Florida, we have deep, warm pools of water. In the Gulf of Mexico, if a hurricane goes over one of those deep, warm pools like Katrina did, like Rita did, it will blow up. It's kind of dumb luck. Now, having said that, research at the University of Miami shows that the Gulf is on average slightly warmer, has been warming every decade slightly. So the increase in warmth of the water affects the hurricane, but the fact is that Hurricane Katrina came along in 1969 at 175 miles per hour. Yep. It was stronger than this and was not even 200 miles from where this one made landfall. So these kinds of hurricanes have happened over the years, and the warming is on the edges, but it is a factor.
Kate Stein, environmental and transportation reporter at WLRN. Scientists will always say not to draw conclusions from any one particular weather event when it comes to climate and climate change, but this report that came out this week from a UN group of scientists regarding climate change had some dire concerns and dire warnings globally. What were some of the takeaways for you?
Well, so this report looked at a threshold basically of 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming, which is about 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. And for some context, we've experienced about 1 degree Celsius of global warming since basically the pre-industrial period. So kind of like when the people of the world started churning out more carbon emissions. Sure. With their, you know, their transportation and factories and everything. So the scientists looked at this 1.5 degree Celsius threshold and how close we are to meeting or surpassing that. And what they found was that if current trends with emissions continue, we are going to hit that number possibly as soon as 2030, so just 12 years from now. They gave a window between 2030 and 2052. And what that means is that the world is going to start to experience potentially many more severe droughts, heat waves. You know, the oceans will rise. Mm-hmm. faster. And another big part of this report was looking at what we can do to not have that happen. Right. And the scientists, they were like, the window is still open for us to save ourselves by cutting emissions, but it's closing very, very quickly.
This was a comprehensive global look at this, but what were the takeaways for you, Kate, for Florida specifically?
So one of the interesting components of this report is that the researchers looked at what if we keep global warming at 1.5 degrees Celsius rather than letting it go higher than that to 2 degrees Celsius. And what I found that was relevant to Florida is they looked at how many people would be affected by sea level rise. Mm-hmm. At 1.5 degrees versus 2 degrees. They looked at the coral reefs and they looked at people affected by water scarcity and heat waves. And they found that if we keep global warming at just 1.5 degrees Celsius, that means 10 million fewer people are going to be affected by sea level rise. Mm. Obviously, that's a big concern for us here. And that keeping it at 1.5 degrees instead of 2 degrees also means that we will still have coral reefs left in the world. If we go to 2 degrees Celsius, we aren't going to have coral reefs anymore. And you think about what that means for South Florida's fishing and tourism and our economy here. That's really important.
Yeah, and coral reefs play a role with storms too, don't they, Brian?
Well, exactly. Any kind of reef actually kind of breaks up the storm surge and affects the storm surge. You know, the discussion of global warming and hurricanes is complicated because both are existential threats to life in Florida, right? Just like Hurricane Michael is going to change forever what Mexico Beach is in the panhandle and have a dramatic effect on Panama City. In South Florida here, there's no question that sea level rise is a threat to life in this region. But next year, a hurricane could come along, like happened in 1926 and happened on other parts of the coast, dramatic hurricanes like Michael, like Andrew, but over the commercial center, that would change life here because it would drive businesses away, drive cruise lines away, drive airplanes away, drive people away that have to get their jobs and have to live and work and can't wait for infrastructure to be restored for months and years. So they are both threats, and they are interlocked eventually. At the current time, they're actually independent threats, and we have to think of them that way.
Well, and it's interesting to hear, too, from political leaders right now who are looking at both this IPCC, the report from the scientists for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and who are, you know, leading the state through this hurricane. I spoke with State Senator Jose Javier Rodriguez earlier this week. He's looking at king tide flooding in
Miami.
Represents
part of Miami, yeah.
Right. And he was saying, you know, this IPCC report really highlights the need for Florida to have a unified statewide plan to respond to climate change. Mm. But I think what we're hearing with Hurricane Michael is the need for, you know, looking at our resilience in terms of not just climate, but hurricanes and the connection between hurricanes and climate. Because you hear about things like how prepared that area is for hurricanes and for potentially storms that get more severe more quickly. And there are clearly gaps.
Well, and it's not even get more severe more quickly. It's just have a real hurricane. You know, they just haven't had any in this period of time that they've had massive development.
Yeah.
The fact is that Florida is a precarious natural environment. It always has been. It always will be. Now we've built these tremendous cities and these huge communities in this precarious natural environment without state leadership on how to do it in a resilient sort of way. And that's fundamentally what's got to change.
We are stuck out on a peninsula squeezed between two great bodies of water, the Gulf of Mexico and the Atlantic Ocean, and the Panhandle as well. We've got phone calls on this issue, 305-995-1800, statewide here on the Florida Roundup. You can also reach us on Twitter, at Florida Roundup. Follow us there as well, at Florida Roundup on Twitter. We'll begin this segment in Tampa with Susan. Susan, you've been very patient. Go ahead.
Hi, I've lived in Florida most of my life, and even without the 97% of the world's scientists sounding the alarm, I have seen these storms and their frequency intensify, not just here in Florida, but all the natural disasters that we're seeing across the globe. I mean, you have to really turn a blind eye not to see the trend following what all the scientists have been warning for years. And I get pretty upset when I hear all these, you know, record this and hottest year on record and hottest September and worst storm and record storm, and the news media not regularly making the connection for the public that doesn't know that this is what we can expect as climate change intensifies. And I think that as human beings, I don't understand how we can be so irresponsible not to act as if this is the emergency that it is. It, whatever the expense is to switch to renewable energy and get away from fossil fuel burning, it's going to be less than the billions, if not trillions, that we're spending on the storms and all the people that are dying as a result of these disasters.
Susan, I hear you. Let me put that to a couple of professional communicators that are with us here right now, a weather forecaster, a meteorologist, and an environmental journalist. What about the critique that Susan has, Brian, about communicating, in her estimation, that connection between these kinds of disasters and the broader picture of climate change?
So let's separate a couple of things. One is, if you're talking about hurricanes, in the 1940s, a Category 4 hurricane hit Miami-Dade County in 1945. A Category 4 hit Broward in 47. A Category 4 hit Monroe in 48. Category 4 hit Palm Beach County in 49.
Strongest ever to hit the continental United States was 1935 in the Keys.
Right, and another Category 4 hit downtown Miami in 1950. So it's not with hurricanes that we're suddenly seeing a lot of strong hurricanes. What we're seeing is hurricanes hitting this spectacularly developed environment with higher sea level nominally higher sea level, you know, on the order of a foot compared to what it was back when all these hurricanes started in the early 20th century. So that's one thing that makes saying this is a global warming climate change issue quite so definite, because in actual fact, in our adult lives, for all the adults listening, we are having more hurricanes because we went through a lull when we were younger. But in our grandparents' lives, there were actually a lot more. So these things are, to some degree, cyclical. Now, that's not at all to say that the heat waves and just the plain old heat that we feel, the number of 90-degree plus days and the acceleration and all the problems that come with that and the coral reef problems and all those things, that's a separate kind of threat.
Yeah.
So for boiling it down, in attribution in broadcasting is a challenge to be accurate, but we have to think of them as both major threats.
Well, and also from, you know, the perspective of someone who tries to be an empathetic journalist, it can be hard to, you know, see this devastation and, you know, be reporting from Miami on what's happening in the panhandle and feel a sense of not guilt, but, you know, is this really the appropriate time to be talking about climate change and global warming and, you know, how that plays into our vulnerabilities to hurricanes through the warming of the oceans and through sea level rise. And, you know, I've given some thought to that, and I feel like, I mean, when else is an appropriate time? You know, our president, his position on climate change, I think, is pretty clear. It's not something that he wants to talk about, to maybe put it delicately. But he will acknowledge, you know, that he keeps talking about these monster storms.
Yeah.
And so there's a news angle to that as well.
Let me remind folks that you are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
But the thing that's it's challenging and I think is important is that if we over-attribute, then we actually do more harm to the message of making people understand that climate change is an existential threat to our lives in Florida, because it gives people that want to be naysayers things to hang their hat on to say, well, look, they oversold it on that point. That's just a challenge of communications in this arena.
Another challenge is just having enough time. Mary in Vero Beach, I want to squeeze your phone call in before we're on a break here. Just a couple of seconds, Mary. Give us your thoughts.
Oh, hi. My thoughts are, I'm tired. I was awake from 4 a.m. to 5 a.m. thinking about just this topic. We have a friend who was dead center, and we can't get a hold of him. We're worried. And I've already been through Francis and Jean. We had a mobile home. We lost that. Bought a house thinking we'll be safe. Not according to what's been happening since then. So my thoughts are, maybe, is it time to go? Do we wait? What if we get wiped out, like what we're seeing on TV? Do I really want, would I rebuild? No.
So as you're thinking about all of this, do you feel like now is the time to talk about climate change? Just very briefly.
Oh, 100%. When you said that, I said, holla, yes. When is it not a good time to talk about it? It bothers me when people don't want to talk about it and not acknowledge it. It's a big deal.
Yeah.
Not just for what we're talking about here, but you also mentioned it changing things here in Florida. My husband...
Mary, we got to run. I'm sorry to interrupt you. And I hope that you're able to get a hold of those folks in the panhandle that you're searching for. Kate Stein with us from our member station, WLRN. Brian Norcross with WPLG Television in South Florida. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Tom.
We're back on the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Thanks again for listening this week. My co-host Melissa Ross is out. She will be back on the broadcast next Friday. Rescue crews are still surveying the damage, combing through the destruction, and tending to those most in need after the destruction left over by Hurricane Michael in the Panhandle. First responders, of course, are on the front lines of this. They come from all walks of life, and the recognition is growing over the long-term risks of the work, well after the danger passes. The link between mental health and traumatic events is well known, but acknowledging that risk to first responders is growing, driven here in Florida by two horrific mass shootings Parkland, and Pulse. Abe Abaraya is a healthcare reporter for our partner station in Orlando, WMFE. He worked on the Trauma After Tragedy project with WMFE and ProPublica. He's with us with those studios in Orlando. Abe, welcome to the Florida Roundup. What kinds of trauma are those first responders potentially subject to after helping out in a situation that they're finding themselves in the panhandle this week?
So there's a couple things to consider with, with a situation like after Hurricane Michael. You know, they're going to be bringing cadaver dogs and they're going to be doing search and rescue. So they're going to be going from home to home looking for hopefully survivors, but unfortunately they're also going to be coming across people who passed away in the storm. So that's going to be a difficult thing for a lot of these first responders. And, you know, the other thing to consider with this is a lot of the responders who are search and rescue and do this kind of work, they're being deployed to, you know, not just the panhandle, but they end up going to natural disasters in other countries, yeah. You know, to Indonesia, to Haiti. And so they're getting exposed to this kind of trauma over and over again. And they, you know, eventually is going to, you know, for a lot of them, cause some effects.
Yeah, that's a great point. I know of a search and rescue crew here with Miami-Dade County Fire Search and Rescue that had just returned from a deployment in the Carolinas because of Hurricane Florence, and just enough time probably to do their laundry before they were back up into a disaster zone in the panhandle.
Exactly. It's, you know, it's an interesting kind of person who, you know, loves to do that work. And obviously a lot of them do find it very fulfilling, but it can be taxing, especially in a year like this where you've got all these, you know, hurricanes back to back and, you know, disasters overseas as well.
Well, I think you're sitting right next to one of those people. Nebel Seiza is a junior. He goes by JR, retired from the Orlando Fire Department, assistant chief there, worked on the department's active shooter plan for years. JR, what are your colleagues who are at work now in the panhandle with the search and rescue efforts underway because of Hurricane Michael? What are they likely potentially to face in the weeks and months to come?
Just a number of hazards right off the bat. I mean, it looks like a war zone. There's buildings that are collapsed. There's buildings they got to search. Some of them unstable. And, you know, God forbid that they have to run across somebody who's passed away. Their mindset right now is search and rescue, the keyword rescue. Mm-hmm. They don't want to lose a life. They don't want to find one dead. They want to make a difference. And I can tell you that these folks that go out, their plan is to find people alive and bring them back home safe. But there's going to be a lot of heartbreak, and it does affect these men and women that go out there and sacrifice themselves.
And what kind of preparation in advance is there in terms of acknowledging that mental health risk for the first responders, JR? You guys and gals get an enormous amount of training when it comes to medical procedures and search and rescue and proper techniques and safety. But what about the acknowledgement and the training regarding the mental health risk?
Thanks for bringing that up. It's an exceptionally important topic. Our organization, along with multiple organizations throughout the country, have a peer support group and CISM, Critical Incident Stress Debriefings, that we do. And it's just now becoming a very huge highlight in public safety that those are tools that we need to realize are there. For the most part, and I've been in the business 30 years, we've talked a lot about CISM, and it was something that if you had an issue, if you were, for lack of a better term, brave enough to step up and say, hey, I got to talk to somebody, you would have got some help. And today, with peer support groups like the ones in Orlando Fire Department, which people like Lieutenant Jeff Orange and others have stepped up and have tried to make sure that this is something that our first responders keep in not in a back burner, but in the front of their head, that if there's something, you see something, feel something, you just need to vent, they're there for that. And I just got to just throw it out there. Our peer support team has been phenomenal. I've spoken to a couple of members, and I can tell you, I feel like these guys have saved some lives of some of our brothers and sisters out there. I'm just bragging about the people that I know. And I think that for the most part in public safety, if you don't have a good, strong peer support, then ask why and push and get yourself educated to save yourself as much as you your brother and sister.
We're talking about first responders, the trauma that they're exposed to after these kinds of tragic events that the Panhandle is experiencing now with Hurricane Michael. Florida has certainly lots of experience with first responders and hurricanes, also first responders and mass shootings. Most recently, of course, the Parkland shooting and the Pulse nightclub shooting in South Florida and in Orlando, respectively. Maybe you are a first responder, the spouse or family member of a first responder. Share your experiences about the trauma after tragedy. 305-995-1800. Statewide, it's 305-995-1800. Or you can follow us on Twitter at Florida Roundup. Abe Abariah, the healthcare reporter at WMFE. JR used a phrase there talking about first responders acknowledging the mental health difficulties that they can experience after a tragedy, saying if they're brave enough to stand up to acknowledge. Talk a little bit about what you encountered in terms of that encounter as you were reporting the Trauma After Tragedy Project.
There are a lot of first responders who don't want to stand up and say, I'm having an issue with this. They don't want their crew members to feel like they're having an issue and maybe are weak or... you know, that they need help and maybe they can't be trusted on a call. And so, you know, that's part of the reason why JR is talking about this peer support program is because the other thing they worry about is from the administration standpoint that, you know, if a supervisor finds out that they're struggling with PTSD or another, you know, mental health concern, that they may be taken off shift, that they may be passed over for promotions. They can, you know, if they're law enforcement, then maybe they're going to lose their gun. And so... that's why the peer support programs are important, because it's coming from within, you know, it's firefighter to firefighter, and it leaves the administration out of it, which, you know, will help them feel a little bit safer to ask for help and, you know, maybe reach out when they are struggling. The other thing that I've come across over and over again with this is first responders who are saying, I didn't know that this was a risk for me because... you know, I show up when someone is hurt, and you understand that maybe if someone has been shot or, you know, has had some, you know, trauma to them, that they might be dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder afterwards. But, you know, there's less, realization that it can happen just from witnessing that and the aftermath of it over and over again, you know, for 20, 30 plus year career.
You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Abe Abariah, let me ask you about the acknowledgement of that link, which has been growing and growing to a point of legislation and a state law in Florida that kind of opens some new routes for first responders to seek assistance for PTSD after a tragedy. Tell us about that.
So earlier this year, after the Parkland shooting, and in my opinion, probably in part because of that shooting, the Florida legislature acknowledged that workers that post-traumatic stress disorder is a work-related condition and therefore should be covered by workers' compensation, which is important because previously it was covered for medical. So, you know, if a first responder had post-traumatic stress disorder, they could get doctor's visits, you know, medications covered. But if they stepped up and said they were having an issue, a doctor could take them off of work, but then they would not be eligible to collect even a workers' compensation paycheck. Yeah. So that's changed now. Which has, I think, helped spread some of the awareness about this across the state, even the existing laws before it. But also importantly with that law is it requires departments now to do training with this, which is going to help as well to sort of spread this, you know, idea to first responders.
JR, how important of a step is that kind of legislation for your colleagues that are still working actively as first responders?
It's exceptionally important. You know, one of the... you know, looking at the statute, one of the unsung heroes that are always left out, unfortunately, are the telecommunicators, the dispatchers. And I was fortunate enough, had the privilege to be the manager over the communication center during the Pulse. And I can tell you the effects they had on those personnel, those men and women in there that had to deal with that.
Hearing
was
those
just
phone
incredible.
Calls. Yeah, hearing those phone calls.
Well, you got the phone calls from people inside begging for help. You got the bad guy, Satan himself, you know, making the phone call, calling in. You know, and then days later, families get told, call the Orlando Fire Department. They know where your family member's at. It was just a very, very tough time. And that's one of the elements in that statute that I think is falling a little bit short. And maybe that's something that they'll take a look at and reexamine it, because there's definitely people. And let's put aside the Pulse incident. You know, these dispatchers and our first responders, they go on incidents that when they see it, they deal with it, they handle it, but it just leaves an indelible mark in the back of their head. And then they have, I think the biggest issue with PTSD is the feeling of hopelessness.
Yeah.
We feel hopeless because we're not there to lose people. We're not there to lose bodies, and to lose somebody and not being able to rationalize the fact that you did everything can sometimes cause some pain.
JR, we appreciate your transparency, your openness, your willing to talk to us here today. Thank you for that. Aníbal Saiza Jr., JR, retired from the Orlando Fire Department, assistant chief there. Abe Abaraya, healthcare reporter with our sister station WMFE in Orlando. You can look for the project Trauma After Tragedy. Gentlemen, thank you for your time here today on the Florida Roundup.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you as well.
That'll do it for our program this week. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJTT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Kevin Murchard and Bridget O'Brien are the producers. Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming and our Technical Director for the hour. WLRN's Director of Radio Operations is Peter Meritz. Engineering help from Doug Peterson. Our theme music provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, tweeting, listening, and supporting Public Radio.